Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Catch with John Fisher on Blog Talk Radio, connecting life to faith.
We're just trying to get it together, trying to help their fellow man, hoping we can make it better. Do you really think we can?
Oh yeah. Yeah, the world is trying to get it together, trying to help their fellow man. We need to get more of that happening, and we're going to get into that some tonight. And we're going to get into how to do that and how not to do that. This is going to be an incredible evening, and I hope that you are with us and that you'll stay with us and be excited to hear what we have to talk about, which is extremely relevant to our goals here at The Catch, and that is to help Christians open the door and get out into the world, into the marketplace. What does faith look like out in the marketplace? And today we're going to actually, and tonight, talking to a person who actually went out to find that out, to actually find personal answers to that question. And you won't believe some of the things that he found out. This is going to be, an hour is not going to do it. I know that, but we'll do what we can. So here we are. Is everybody? Marty is in the chat room. Marty, are you there?
I'm there. Hello, everybody.
Yeah, all ready to go. Fantastic. And Gunnar, are you with us?
I am here from Portland, Oregon, with my Christmas tree lights on and my candles lit. I'm ready.
Yeah, you're way ahead of us.
All right, I got the
Christmas tree up, but no lights. And how do you do that in Portland, Gunnar?
Well, you know, it's pretty easy because, you know, it's Oregon. You know, everybody's got trees. And so, you know, you just go next door with a saw. And I hope my neighbor didn't hear, isn't tuning in tonight. But anyway, they won't know a thing. You know, then what we do is, you know, then there's always the story of my friend who, you know, he when he was done with Christmas tree, he just kind of had it on the side of the house until someone came over to view the house because they wanted to buy the house. And his wife was like going, what are you going to do with that tree? And so he quickly got a shovel out, replanted it, but it was like a dead tree. And so, oh, the stuff we do in Oregon.
Yeah.
I don't even know what any of that meant.
I'm sure that the tree that we have in our house right now was from Oregon. That's where they all come from, isn't it?
I think Oregon is. We've White House and I think we sent trees everywhere over the time. But so you got to get the lights out. What's the plan on the lights? When do you guys plan on having those up?
John.
Well, see, the lights are my job, and
okay.
And we traditionally, because we have a vaulted ceiling, we can take a pretty tall tree.
Yeah.
And so we got a nice tall tree in there, and it usually takes me at least 2 hours to put the lights on properly.
So
it's finding
we're gonna,
the time, which usually
yeah.
ends up to be between 1 and 3 in the morning at some point. Yeah.
So you got to, when you do that, though, you got to take a picture of that so you can, you know, accountability wise, and post it on Facebook so we can all see it.
There you go.
Oh.
There you go, John.
Oh. That's what you do. Is that what you do?
Yeah.
That's one of the things you do with Facebook, right?
That's all you really do with Facebook.
Boy.
You know what? I'll do that tonight as well, facebook.com/thecatch. I'll post it. And if anybody's listening tonight and you got a Christmas tree up, hey, take a picture of it. Even if it's not yours, just get a clip art picture from the Internet and then post it on our Facebook page and just say, hey, look, check out our deal.
Hey, Marty, can you help me do that?
Yes, don't
Marty,
most definitely.
You can help me do that.
I'll even take some pictures of you at 1 o'clock in the morning, putting the lights up.
Putting the lights on. Okay, very good.
Very good.
In action. Awesome. Well, this is going to be a fun show tonight, you know. And real quickly, we are on Marty's in the chat room. If you're listening, you know, and you're on blogtalkradio.com, just keep on scrolling towards the bottom of that page, and you're going to see the chat window is going to be there. You can jump in the dialogue. And, Marty, are you ready for some action in the chat room tonight?
Most definitely. I'm trying to get some – there's five people that are in the chat room right now, but they're not answering me. I'm asking, hello, everyone. How's everybody? And no one's responding to me.
Uh-oh, I better jump in there myself. I'm going to do that, too.
Go wake them up.
We'll figure that out. And in the meantime, we usually take a few minutes at the beginning of the show to talk about some kind of current event, and I always like to tie it in with our subject, which obviously is set by whoever our guest is. And the thing is, there's just no way I can introduce this guest without talking a little bit. And this isn't so current, but well, it is. It's a little bit about my own experience, and I am so connected with our guest today and the process by which he has come to the movie he made that we're going to discuss here in a few minutes, because I've gone through the same thing. I often feel, going back to the Jesus movement, And the beginnings of a revival, and those early years, they were incredible years, because non-Christians came to our events. Jesus Rock was a cool idea, and then suddenly it became that window was open for about 2 years. I think of 1972 is when I think that window started to close, and suddenly it's like they figured this out, and only Christians now are coming to Christian concerts, and yet a whole new industry was born with the record companies, promotion companies, production companies, and everybody going on tour. And the non-Christians aren't coming anymore, but we've got all these brand new Christians who are dying for their faith to be expressed in their own music and the terms in which they came to Christ through the music in many ways. And so we just kept writing it and kept touching those people through our music. But then I watched what happened over the next few years as it started to become not just Christian music, but Christian books and Christian this and that, and pretty soon we had a whole moral majority, we had a Christian coalition, we had a political party, we were putting people in the White House, and it seemed like overnight this thing morphed into something that I always questioned in my mind, is this right? Is this really what we're supposed to be doing? And one of the books I finally got around to writing when I figured this out is called Fearless Faith, or Living Beyond the Walls of Safe Christianity, because what happened to help me realize what was right and what was wrong about what was happening was to realize that for a lot of the stuff we call Christian, I had to look at it really honestly and say, this stuff is fear-based. People are creating a Christian alternative to the world, not to reach the world like we were trying to do, but they're creating a Christian alternative so that they can have a safe place to raise their kids, send them to school, they can have a safe environment for themselves. It's no longer we trying to save the neighborhood. We just want a safe enough neighborhood for ourselves. I'm sorry to say, it got very selfish, and I just feel like fear took over, and that's the way I began to look at this culture that was growing, and then suddenly, Christians became not only afraid, but they became angry, and we have the culture wars, and we have this whole animosity built between Christians and non-Christians. Where did that come from? You know, it's still with us today, Connor. I think it, you know, it's not as heightened as it was maybe in a few years back, but we still see it today manifested towards, you know, abortion issue and definitely towards gay people. It's a kind of a negative kind of animosity towards people and what they're going to do to us and to our, you know, to the, our way of life. And we're going to try and get America back because America is supposed to be Christian, right? And these are things which I believe actually became a hindrance to the gospel. And am I ringing a bell here at all, Gunner?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I keep on thinking about what you're saying and the conversations that we've had and this safe, you know, subculture that we've created this bubble. And you know, the irony is, as we talk about that, what you're saying, and of course we bring in our guest tonight. You know, when I had found out and I was introduced to this film, which has just been it's been a huge part of my walk and journey the last many years that it's been out. At the time, I was actually running a bookstore chain in a Christian bookstore chain, my movie came out, and just of course knowing Dan and Jeff and the guys that worked on it put this thing together, it touched my heart, and it was like, yeah, you know, I was trying to really figure out, okay, what does a business look like that you run that's according to Matthew 6:33 of, you know, seek ye first the kingdom of God, what does that look like?
Yeah.
And so to me, it really resonated. So the irony is of what you're saying is that's where I was when I found out about this movie.
Wow. Wow. And this movie in many ways was Dan, our guest tonight, with a microphone and a camera, walking out into the street and finding out how we got where we were. Who are these people? Who are the Christians? Who are the non-Christians? What do they think of each other? And basically just gather the information and present it to us. And it was a long time coming and much needed. And I think it still speaks very, it's just, what, movie's been out for about 5 years now. Lord, save us from your followers. You know, it's just amazing we had to get to this, but we did get to this. It reminds me of the other bumper sticker I saw that that said, I'm for the separation of church and hate. You know, how do these things happen? I mean, that obviously says that, you know, church and hate have been put together for some reason, and they have. And our guest today walked in the middle of that, and to try and report it and find out some things. And the beautiful thing I think that I found from watching his movie is that he didn't leave us there. He didn't just report on what was bad, but he found what was good too. And he moved the movie through to a conclusion that I think can help us all. So, we're going to talk about all of that. Dan, I hope, is with us. Everybody, I want you to meet Dan Merchant, filmmaker, writer. Hi, Dan. You know, we're just so excited to have you with us on the show tonight, and can't wait to get into some of these issues. But I think first, I just, you know, I'm curious as to how you got into making films in the first place. How did you get into the industry?
You know, I was infected as a youngster, you might say, and I was the kid who would show up to summer camp with a typed out sketch, comedy skits for talent night, and I just felt we owed a better product to our audience. So how I got that way, I don't know, but I was a fan of you know, of movies and music growing up. So I suppose when you listen to the Beatles and go see Young Frankenstein as an impressionable kid, you go, That's what quality entertainment looks like. And I just appreciated how those great artists, you know, from, you know, Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder to Lennon and McCartney were able to express and reflect about the world. And I guess I felt like that was in me somewhere to be able to try and share, you know, my experience or reflect experiences with, you know, to others.
Yeah. Now, Dan, you were not, we're not and maybe never have been involved in what we might call today Christian film. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, no, that's correct. No, I had worked for you know, sketch comedy show that was on Comedy Central. I've done a few, you know, pilots for Fox Television. I had a rock and roll Twilight Zone anthology show called Strange Frequency that played on VH1. Back in the day with Roger Daltrey from The Who and John Taylor from Duran Duran and people like that were in the show, and it was great fun. So no, I had never done anything that you know, I'd always done everything through Hollywood basically.
Yeah.
And I guess the good and the interesting about that, none bad for me, the good and the interesting is that you're working with all kinds of people that don't necessarily share your beliefs, and you're working with excellent people who are very disciplined and very good at the craft, and I learned an awful lot.
Yeah, sad to say, what happened through a lot of that in Christian stuff is that we let a lot of inferior things slip by because, well, it was for the ministry's sake. Or here's the other thing. Here's the other thing that was amazing to me. We had a lot of music that got recorded and put out there, mainly because the people they were singing to didn't know any better. They didn't even know what the music was supposed to sound like.
Yeah, having an easy room is not necessarily good for the art.
No, it's not. It's not. And so I'm really excited about that part of your history that that you had to hone your talent out there in the marketplace just like everybody else had to. Where did your faith come to play in this? You know, was it in the early years or did it grow or
I was somebody who always was trying to figure it out. I had parents that split when I was young, but they were both you know, trying to figure it out in their own way. And my mom ended up with a fairly charismatic kind of Christian bent, I guess. So there was a lot of speaking in tongues and waving your hands during the songs and stuff like that. When I went to church with her, and then my father was a much more kind of intellectual type, being a Stanford aerospace engineer, a PhD. So he liked to understand how and why it worked, which is kind of interesting with faith because the math doesn't always work. But so he introduced me to lots of great thinkers, Eastern religion, lots of different elements. So I was sort of exposed to the wide marketplace of belief and kept coming back to Jesus personally, mostly because it just didn't make any sense. You know,
wow.
It seemed, and by that I mean it was so counterintuitive. What he preached and what he seemed to think was important made me feel good inside. And it also seemed darn near the opposite of, you know, the culture that we were growing up in. And I guess make no mistake that we Christians are the culture. So that was interesting that if Jesus is talking about, you know, being around and rubbing shoulders with, you know, the lepers and the harlots, why aren't we again? So those sorts of conflicts were really fascinating to me, and I also was intrigued by the fact that those who decided to drop all they had and follow him, it wasn't like a world tour with Led Zeppelin or something. It was a hard road, and it didn't end particularly well for most of them. So I thought that was fascinating too. It's like what the incongruity in a way between the power of the Gospels and just the way it hit my heart. And the way I was seeing it in the world, and I don't know, it just seemed to me that if more people did the stuff that Jesus was talking about, this might be a better place to live in.
Wow. You're sounding a little bit like Blaise Pascal right now to me. And that's, yeah. you know, faith is obviously a process, but can you point to some time in which you can say, you know, Jesus became very real to you at that point in your life?
Yeah, there's been a handful of things that were just at the time feel like strange serendipity, and and then later you go, oh wow, you know, he caught me and guided me this way. And you know, I can think of one incident that just pops off the top of my head was after my freshman year in college, where I more or less struggled through but was doing okay, and didn't want to return home and was trying to figure out what to do, and kind of had a just sort of a lost weekend trying to figure out what was next. And I got a phone call from a friend who was going to have to give up her job in the TV department at the university I was attending, and did I want to go take that job and live on campus for the summer. And it was just the weirdest out of left field thing, and it was exactly what I needed, and it really kind of got me on the fast track at the university and in with the different professors and staffers who were running the studio and the equipment. And I just spent that whole summer kind of immersed in my craft, and it wasn't lost on me even the first week I was there that, wow, if that phone call doesn't come out of the blue, what happens next? And it just was so right about what was supposed to happen. And you know, there's a handful of things like that every so often that, that just strike you in retrospect as being significant.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I can always look back and you can see God's hand. The strong, I think of a Mark Kurtz song. Gunnar, you'll know this one, "The Strong Hand of Love Hidden in the Shadows." You know, I just think that works so often in our life. Well, you know, Lord, save us from your followers. When did it dawn on you that I'm going to make this movie? I'm going to tell this story.
You know, there were two flashpoints, I guess. One flashpoint was it happened on a trip to Africa. I was in Ethiopia, and my production company, myself and Jeff Martin, the business partner in that concern, were invited to go along with a United Nations tour to look at all of the work that essentially Western money had done to Ethiopia, improve the conditions there since the Great Famine of 1984. So it was almost like a 20th anniversary reunion tour, if you will. And Jim Standridge, who was the videographer for Lord Save Us, as it turned out. Well, what we didn't know at the time was we started filming Lord Save Us while there to do this other business. It just sort of happened. The way it sort of happened, you know, and that was another one of those God guiding you things. Mm-hmm. I was scared to death to go on this trip. As soon as the opportunity came up, I was just like gripped in fear. And luckily I was mature enough to go, oh, if I'm really afraid of this, maybe there's a reason I'm supposed to go. I guess I'm a follower of C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters and his take on how the evil team works, and it's with little quiet whispers. So I heard those whispers, recognized maybe what they were, and went, well, okay, I guess I got to go now. And anyway, a quick story of something that happened there. You know, I was able to see, you know, Muslims and Christians in villages getting along. They were neighbors, and, you know, I was being told, of course, that this wasn't possible, and that was confusing and interesting to see. I also saw so many Christians from around the world, a lot of Americans, a lot of Western Europeans as well, who were there doing this beautiful, difficult work and not talking a whole lot about it. You knew why they were there, but it was not like they were broadcasting, you know, what their motivation was. You just saw this incredible work, and then you'd find out, oh, they're from this church in Indiana, or there are these people from such and such. And you go, wow, there's something very loud and articulate coming from those silent people, people in need. So that left a mark. And then I guess lastly, I I remember a conversation I had with a young man at a school, and we were maybe 500 miles from any other school. We were 3 or 4 hours easily, maybe more outside of the capital. And this young man and I were talking, and he was going to graduate. He was a 19-year-old who was going to graduate and wanted to go to America, go to college, and then come back and be a doctor in his village. And what we were talking about was Jesus. And he was so happy to meet a Christian from America. And one of the things he said was, even though we speak in a different tongue, in heaven, we'll speak with one tongue because we're brothers in Christ. And I'm like, wow, that's really nice. And he said, even though our skin color is different, you know, we're still part of the same family because we love Christ. And, you know, I'm thinking all this stuff would be really nice on a Hallmark card. He's very sweet. And I, you know, wasn't quite, you know, engaging thoroughly. But I thought, you know, he wants to play. So, okay, let's talk a little bit. And so I said, tell me who Jesus is to you. And it was funny because the one thought I had was I imagined that his picture of Christ and mine were probably different because we come from very different worlds. And because my image of Christ is Max von Sydow from The Greatest Story Ever Told. So I picture a red-headed, blue-eyed Dutchman as Jesus. So clearly Fox and I agree on that. So here's what the kid said to me. He said, well, my father died of AIDS, but not for me. And my mother, she died of AIDS, but not for me. Jesus Christ, he died for me.
Oh.
It's so powerful. And the peace on his face and the kindness on his face, and probably what he was thinking was, well, I'll explain it to this Westerner. He probably won't get it, but I'll do him the courtesy. So he said these words to me. And I'm still embarrassed all these years later to admit that the first thought that rushed into my pea brain was, wow, this kid really sounds like he believes this stuff. And then the very next thought was, hey, wait, isn't that what you believe? And I'll tell you what, man, it was like Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo, you know, just that falling, you know, the rug got pulled. And I was really disturbed by how foreign those words sounded to me. And they're my words. But I wanted what he had. So that was a pretty powerful moment to try and contemplate, you know, am I happy because my wife loves me and she's a great woman, or because my kids are healthy and they're great guys, or because I have a big TV that I get to watch the NCAA playoffs on, or am I happy because I know God loves me? And I just met a person who's happy and content just because the master of time, space, and dimension loves him. And that messes with you. So I came home. I came home after, and it was in the run up to a George Bush's reelection in fall of 2004, and the Christians, kind of like you alluded to in your preamble tonight, were the guys on TV who were divisive, and the rhetoric was political and strident, and I started to look at this kid in Africa that I met and the fellows that I see on TV as kind of opposite poles. And so really that space between those two positions, this kid with nothing who loves God and loves Jesus and reminds me of Jesus, and frankly, my tribe, I have way more in common with Pat Robertson and James Dobson than I did with this kid. So that was kind of crushing to go, oh, no. I'm them. I don't get to throw a rock at them. I'm them. And that is step one for what ended up being a 5-year journey to make and release this film, Lord Save Us From Your Followers.
Wow, what a story. That's amazing. You know, which leads me to want to ask you, you've already actually kind of answered it, but maybe you can take this a little bit farther. Well, one, I'm amazed, and it sounds like you started with the end of your movie. You started with what the answer was going to be, and then you worked more on the question. Is that right?
Well, gosh, if I'd known that at the time, I probably could have saved some time. Yeah, I think you're probably right, but I didn't know it.
Isn't that? No kidding. Because that, yeah, how much of your own search do you think was involved in the making of this movie?
Oh, 100%. I mean, the whole thing, you know, when I went out and asked anybody from, you know, Rick Santorum to Al Franken to, you know, Tony Campolo to Sister Mary Timothy, the gay nun in San Francisco.
Yeah.
When I asked any of those people, why do you think the gospel of love is dividing America? What do you think that's about? I was asking for me as much as anyone. And that's probably why the movie connects with people, because it is an honest, personal journey. I didn't start with an agenda. I didn't start with, okay, well, here's, we're going to show how Christians aren't as bad as everyone thinks, or here's how we're going to show why we shouldn't be in politics. It's none of that. It's,
wow,
I'm trying to figure out what is this disconnect all about, and what is this disconnect in me? Why could I talk with that lovely young man in Africa and just have my life turned upside down because I thought I was set. I thought I was squared away. And I'm like, I want what that guy has. And that guy lives in a hut with his three, you know, orphaned brothers and sisters, and they have to bring the yak in at night so the hyena doesn't get it. That's the life I'm envious of, you know, that peace and contentment. And so I don't know. And I suppose along the way when I started interviewing people and just people on the street and was trying to discover, is it possible to have a conversation with somebody that, you know, you're probably not going to agree with things on or everything on, is that even possible? And when I started to find that completely possible, then I sort of got to see behind the veil, behind the curtain, and go, oh, this whole thing is just about money and power, which is what everything's about.
Wow.
And I'm going to try and do an end run here until somebody shuts my camera off.
Wow. It's amazing to me that I've been thinking a lot about your movie. That's why I responded the way I did when you first told me that story about the gentleman in Africa, because to me that's where you ended. That is where you ended your movie. But you're telling me that you didn't even know that at the time. And isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing the way God works through our lives, and there's a process of the opening of our mind and our discovery of these things. What would you tell? How do you have a conversation with somebody with a completely different view than you? How can we help our listeners on that one? How do we do that?
Yeah, I think the first thing is don't enter the conversation with an agenda. Don't take your friend to lunch with the agenda of having them saved or corrected before, you know, dessert. Just go in with an open heart, and if you genuinely care about this person, then be a good listener and be genuinely, you know, concerned about what they have to say, and try and really hear them. You know, sometimes we think listening is, you know, keeping our mouths shut until they take a breath, and then we get to jump in and correct what that stupid thing they just said.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes we're, you know, we got to think about context, and we got to think about hearing between the words and around the words and things like that. But if we're really interested in what the other has to say, then my experience is, and I can name 30 strange venues where it's true and field tested, is if people believe that we care about what they have to say, A, they will tell us, and they will be honest, and we will be better for having heard it and challenged. And sometimes it's as basic as, oh, my gosh, when I say this, you hear I hate you? Oh, no. Let me say it in another way then, because that's not at all what I'm trying to say. And sometimes it's semantics, and sometimes it's really basic, and it's really simple. And then other times, you know, it's a lot more difficult, and it requires much more of us. And again, that's, you know, that's what I see out of Jesus' followers. His disciples were, you know, like I said, it was not a gravy train. And they were learning hard lessons along the way too. So I don't feel so bad. I mean, Peter's standing right next to him and he's getting it wrong. So,
What, you know, what about, here's something I really liked about your movie was that the debate section where you had the conservatives debating the liberals. And, you know, what I loved about that was that they seemed to mention it at the end. They all met in the green room and had a wonderful time chatting with each other for about 2 hours. And,
that's right.
It seems to me that something happens when you get people to get it's. Would you say that this is right? It's the culture and the media that pushes us out to the edges of this polarity that we have. And that by actually coming together, we find out that we're all more closer to each other than we thought. Is that
I think that's fair. Yeah, I mean, you know, you'll notice in the film, there's no accident that the debate you were talking about was a game show, right? We staged a Family Feud style game show and intentionally labeled people. I think we had the young conservative team against the agnostic scholars, when we had the young college kids who were atheists against the Christians, or the liberal media elite team against the young conservative team. So we sort of appropriated the labels of the quote culture, the media culture, and went, okay, you're just this and you're just that. And we set the rules up. And then because we were playing a game, everybody falls in line and plays the game. Our team's over here counting points. Your team's over there counting points. And it really, we were trying to illustrate the us versus them mentality that you're absolutely right is absolutely an American idea, I think. And it's, you know, it's white cowboy hat versus black cowboy hat. It's just easy. It's an easy story to tell that people get. And that's why, you know, that's why cable news does so well. You know, Bill O'Reilly can get on there and be the white hat and yell at the black hats. And, you know, those guys will go out and have drinks after the show. You know, they're friends, but this is entertainment. And sometimes we don't realize they're just trying to entertain
us.
It's not real. You know, it's just not true. And same with politics to a certain degree. All those guys are members of the same country club. They golf together. You know, they're out there having their filibuster against each other, then they go have a round of golf. So, you know, that gets for some reason that's not as well known or as easily understood as what it means to put on your uniform and go against your opponent. And so, again, what we're trying to do with the whole movie, and certainly that game show segment, is the game that's set up is us versus them, and I'm just suggesting, why don't we play we for a while? What happens if we get together? And that's the part I didn't plan on for the show, was when people went into the green room, and then they hung out and wouldn't leave. It's like they wanted to share the experience they had with their, quote, opponents, and they made friends with each other. And it was like, wow, that was fantastic. I mean, on one hand, I wish I had cameras in the green room to capture it all, but I guess I like that it organically happened on its own. But that was proof for the little experiment, for it to end for them to choose, we want to be together, as opposed to let's be opponents, you know, until we get in our cars and drive away from the studio.
Yeah. Dan, I imagine you could probably fill up a book with the things that you learned from this, and I think you, by the way, did. Isn't that right?
As a matter of fact, I did. That's right. Lord Save Us From Your Followers is a book and a movie. The book I wrote sort of during the editing of the movie, when I realized, you know, we were going to take 100 hours of material and cut it down to 100 minutes. And, you know, a movie works different than a book, you know, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's a different experience. And so the book, you get to hear a lot more of, here's what I was thinking and here's some of what I went through, and parts of interviews that, you know, you can't play the whole Tony Campolo interview as much as I'd like to. Or, for example, the confession booth scene at the end, you know, we cut it certain ways to kind of help illustrate what happened. But in the book, for example, you get to see complete interviews with some of the people that I shared my confession with, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. very rich conversation with afterwards. So anyway, it's a different thing. But yeah, you're right. There's lots to talk about.
you can go deeper. You can go much deeper with the book. It makes me want to get it. It really does. I was leading into something with that question, and that is, of course, you could fill a book with the things you learned from this, but can you tell us maybe just one or two of a couple things that really stand out that made the biggest impression upon you?
So you mean like my own kind of personal takeaways from the journey?
Yeah.
Or is that what
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess one thing is that I try and do, and this may be my next book title, is that whenever I talk to people, like just as friends or in whatever setting, and I'm talking about this stuff, I try and make an effort to just plagiarize Jesus. And by that, I mean, you know, it's really nice that everyone gets their own opinion, but if we're really trying to be productive and helpful, then, you know, Jesus kind of has some pretty interesting and humble and beautiful approaches to these complicated questions. So I kind of start with his stuff, which, you know, at the Last Supper, when he boils it down after Judas leaves, he boils it down to, you know, the new commandment, you know, love each mm-hmm. other. You know, you must love one another as I have loved you. All the people will know you are my followers because you love one another. Like, well, if we did that, like what I saw in Africa and like where I saw under the, you know, mm-hmm. Burnside Bridge in Portland, there aren't a lot of questions when that's how we lead with things. You know, if people feel loved, if we're behaving in a way where my success is linked to your success, then there isn't a whole lot of confusion. You know, when we start trying to parse things out and create our own definition of what we're willing to put up with, then it gets really messy and really complicated. And I don't know, it just feels like Jesus had a chance to say, instead of love one another, he could have said, judge everybody. You know, once everybody gets judged and you get them all straight, then let's talk about love. How come he didn't say
that? Wow.
You know?
Yeah. And I love the way that you work towards that, and that you pretty much leave us with that at the end of this movie. I'm most intrigued, and I'm assuming that maybe a lot of our listeners have not, you know, seen the movie. I don't know if they haven't. The confession booth was certainly an amazing experience. Must have been an amazing experience for you, for everyone. And Connor, I just saw the time. In as briefly as possible, can you maybe just share a little bit about that experience, what it was, and what it pulled out of people?
Yeah, no, real briefly, what I tried to do with that really was sort of a social experiment. And one of the things about the Gospels that just blows me away, I mean, essentially it's God's grace and how forgiving and how much room he's given me with all of my mistakes through the years, and he's still there to love me. And I thought about, you know, certain things like, you know, the Pope John Paul II's Jubilee Apology, Don Miller and Tony the Beat Poet in the book Blue Like mm-hmm. Jazz do a similar confession booth on the campus of Reed College, and I thought, wow, mm-hmm. those little gestures really encapsulate this bigger truth. Where would be where's the toughest place we could do that? And something like that. And the first thing that popped into my head was gay pride. And I literally, as soon as that idea hit, I literally looked up at the ceiling, through the ceiling to heaven, and went, really, God? Gay pride? Is that the best idea you can give me? Really? So that, again, kind of like the Africa trip, I got scared about it and went, well, I heard it right. I need to go do it. So that we bought a booth and built it and set it up like a confession booth with the, you know, the gold velour, or the kind of the red curtains, the mm-hmm. velour curtains, and a Mother Mary, and, you know, the wood carving, the whole thing. And the idea was to, for me to confess my sins against the gay community, and then also as a representative of the church for the church's failures, you know, with the AIDS crisis and kind of in general of choosing judgment over love. And, you know, we didn't really know what was going to happen. And the organizers of the event, while, you know, accepting our money and letting us, you know, buy our space and put our booth up, they said, nobody's going to come. You know that, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, I guess we'll see. And the truth of it was I spent 8 hours in there and interviewed 28 people, and something like another 60 had signed up to come in and talk. But, you know, again, because I didn't know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And what happened was these beautiful conversations, and some of them pretty difficult, but mostly redemptive at the end. And it was shocking. Some of the things that people said was that, you know, things like, I've never heard a Christian say anything nice before. People saying, mm-hmm. I don't feel worthy of the apology. People apologizing back to me for how they've disliked Christians. People admitting and commenting that, hey, the reason I don't go to church anymore is because of how I've been treated by church people or how I've been hated by Christians. And I have to say that for as beautiful and powerful as the exchanges were, I had never felt that kind of sadness before. And I absolutely left there that night wearing the pain and the rejection and the neglect and the lack of love and civility that those people have experienced and probably experience in their daily lives, ways large and small. You know, I work in entertainment, so, you know, it's not my first exposure to gay folks and gay friends, but boy, to really just open my heart in that way to them, and they opened their hearts to me. And the truth of it is, when you feel that weight and that hurt, you really are committed to do something to better represent this love that we say we have, and the love that Christ has for everyone. And that was a, you know, in it, there you go. There's my 3-minute answer for a life-changing experience.
I'm speechless. That's painful to hear, and it's wonderful to hear too. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time. What do we, Gunnar? I feel like we just started here and could talk for hours and hours with you, Dan. But let's just. What can we tell? What can we tell our listeners right now? You know, what would you like to say? It's something to encourage them here. You know, how can we distinguish ourselves from that which is, you know, wrong about the way Christians are perceived? Now, I'm not even putting the blame on them. I just put the blame on the perception. How can we distinguish ourselves from that wrong perception? And how can we get in the right direction with people in the world here?
Well, you know, I guess a couple of quick things. You know, there were things that I learned the way one learns when an anvil drops on your head, is that, you know, when we talk about the truth, we got to stand up for the truth, we got to defend the truth, let's talk about the whole truth, and that truth is embodied and wrapped in love. So if we're not demonstrating love, if we're not living out God's love, which the Bible explains extremely clearly what love is. If we're not doing that, then we're not really talking about the truth. I guess another thing that's just, we can slow down and take a breath. I mean, the Bible says these things. God is love. Everyone is an image bearer of God. If those two things are true, those two biblical things are true, which the entire Bible is built on those truths, then we should believe them.
mm-hmm.
We should start there. And again, if Jesus oversimplifies and gives us a new commandment, the greatest commandment, love one another, let's start there. Start with trying to see each other the way God probably sees the other person. And when I look at Sister Mary Timothy, when I looked at him the first time,
yeah,
I didn't see him the way God did. I saw him the way I did, and I was freaked out. And mercifully, God worked on my heart. And then I see him the way God sees him, and he's a beautiful, wonderful, spirited human being, creation of God, fellow image bearer. So I think if we just took a breath and reminded ourselves, we don't have to figure it all out. Now, why and how is it, are you, me, Gunner, and Marty, and my wife, how are we all image bearers when we look so different? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how it works, but that's what it says. So if we're going to believe this stuff, let's not just believe the parts that we can simply understand. Let's be okay with God's mystery. Let's be okay with the fact that we're on a big journey to know him, and it's complicated, and it requires a lot of us. And be okay with that, you know. And like you said at the start, if you're motivated by fear, then we're doing it wrong. If you're doing something because you're afraid something bad's going to happen, oh, you're afraid of those people that moved into the neighborhood, you're afraid of this. If fear is your motivator, that's not love, and that's not God. So that's fascinating to me. So, I mean, I check myself daily on why am I nervous? Why am I scared about that? What am I? I need to give it up to God. Here I am trying to grab the wheel again. So anyway, those are a couple of quickies, and they're hard to do, by the way.
Yeah.
Looking at people trying to love them the way God does, not easy.
Wow. Well, Dan, hey, Marty, Gunner, you guys, you let me have the ball tonight, do you have anything to say or add?
From the chat room, everyone is just tracking exactly with Dan, and you should be encouraged, and I'll send you some of the comments of this. They're just tracking with you and removing their fear and replacing it with the Lord's love. So way to go, Dan.
That's beautiful.
Yeah,
well,
nice.
Dan, will you come back sometime?
Oh, anytime. Absolutely, anytime, John. It's my pleasure. I appreciate what you do with The Catch. I read it daily, and as I've commented before, turning out material on a daily basis is not an easy thing, and I appreciate the high bar of excellence that you maintain, and I enjoy the thought-provoking pieces, and it'd be my pleasure to come back again.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, and thanks for the compliment, we'll get everybody to see this movie. I think everybody listening is to make sure they see this movie, and I'm going to go get your book now. So thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
And whatever you're working on right now, we can talk about that next time, but I pray it goes well.
Thank
love
you.
To your family. Yeah, thank you.
All right, much appreciated. Take care, you guys.
Yeah. Wow.
How about that?
That was incredible. He got me there at the end, though. Yeah, the way he just identified with the pain of the gay people have experienced from us, wow.
Well, I'll tell you what. You know, when I was alluding to earlier, meeting with Dan early on and as they were working on the movie, you know, it's really made an impact on my life to a place where, you know, I really, a lot of times I call myself now pro people in that, I'm going to meet people where they're at, not where I'm at, you know, and to lead with that. And that really stemmed from, you know, this movie and discussions that, you know, Dan and I have had and over coffee and such. And so, you know, it's challenged me. It's helped. I mean, I think the Lord has used that in my life, and so I'm just so happy to see Dan here on The Catch on Blog Talk Radio, and Marty, how about the chat room? We had some great dialogue going on tonight.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it's just popping with excellent responses, or they're with Dan and his thinking, and almost from the view of, thank God there's somebody else out there that is willing to move with love instead of fear. This is, I wish I could tell you. I mean, Gigi just said a lot of blessings come in ways we don't expect and often in disguise. I mean, I really wish you could see them all. They're just amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I think you're spot on, you know, John, and having Dan come back. He's always got his hands on something new he's working on, and his son with his new record. We may have to have him on the show at some point and talk about his new song. That'd be fun.
Okay, excuse me, I have to stop because there's a very important announcement. Tim, I hope you didn't mind me. Never mind, let's see his last name. Tim is telling me that he's got his Christmas picture ready to post on your Facebook site, John, as soon as the friend request is accepted. He's already moving on the Christmas tree. This is so good.
You can also go to facebook.com/thecatch. I'll post it in the room right now. facebook.com/thecatch, and you can post it on the wall there as well. And we're going to be waiting on you, John, to get these lights up.
Yes. John's son, his 14-year-old son, is great. Really? It's not up yet? No, definitely. We have to put some more pressure on him.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, John, what a show. What a show, huh?
Yeah, I think this is, they're all great. But, this one really stands out. This is right at the heart, Gunnar, of why I think the Catch exists.
Yeah.
This is right at the heart of what we're trying to get people to rethink their faith out in the culture.
Yeah.
And, boy, this guy is just right in there. He is right in there. And what amazed me, Gunnar, was how much he was involved, you know, in this whole process himself, and how personally invested in trying to find the answer he was. And so much so that I'm still baffled by that question I asked him that revealed even to him that he had the answer before he knew it. He had the end of his movie. He had the end of his movie before he realized it.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
I think he had you a couple times, you know, and I could sense that you were really moved on a few of those places. But, you know, this is the exciting thing about this Blog Talk Radio thing. I mean, we're coming up as our 8th episode. You can listen to this on demand. You're going to get more of this in the new year. As we look to 2014, there's some exciting things coming with the Catch, aren't there?
Oh, yeah. We've got some great, great guests coming on. And, I don't even know if I should mention a few names. What do you think?
Well,
I know who I want. I know we're going to have Michael W. Smith on because I know for sure. I just don't know when.
Ozgenes.
There you go, and my very good friend Noel Stuckey, I know will be on, I just have to nail him down. But Peter Paul Mary, he's Paul of Peter Paul Mary, one of the most just wonderful human beings I know of. So we're going to have some great fun here, and then Gunnar has this way of pulling these amazing people that we never even heard of. That are involved in the incredible work.
We're all on this journey together, and you know, of course, the other name. We've got about a minute left here, but we've got time to mention this. Of course, you know, the other name that we're going to be having on here in the new year will be Leighton Ford. We were going to have him on sooner. Who's brother-in-law to Billy Graham, and so you know, with that, of course, you know, I want to mention, hey, we need to, you know, let's keep Billy in the Billy Graham family in our prayers. Now, and as he's seemingly not doing well, and so we definitely want to keep him in the prayers. With that, John, I got the Angels song set up again 2 weeks in a row to send this out.
It's there my you favorite go. Song. My favorite.
Is that your
song.
Favorite song? Is that your favorite song,
yeah.
Marty?
My favorite.
Okay, real quickly, 2 seconds. Why is it your favorite song?
The Angels song.
Why is it
really?
He wants to know why. Why is it your favorite?
It's the wide angle. It's holding everything out there and pulling it all back together again.
Boy, that's a great way to put it. Well, how about we send it off right now with it?
Good night, Benner. Good night, John.
Yep. Good night, you guys.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, go out there and listen first, everybody. Listen.
In the town of Bethlehem, a king and ruler child was born. Not too many people noticed, just some shepherds on their farm.